Future Hacker. Life. Path. Future.
Apoio Instituto Brasileiro de Ciências e Inovações.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Future Hackers. This is the second episode of our interview with Richard Steele. Richard is going to launch a book soon that is actually already available for pre-order on Amazon called Elevated Economics. So it's all about how consumers are changing the way that they purchase and how companies they have to rush now to actually respond to this demand from the market. We talked about this great wealth migration that is happening pretty soon with the new generations to come, and how the money is going to be used for actually as a vote. So people will just actually invest in companies that are going to make a positive impact in the world. So this is a lot of amazing content. If you haven't heard the first episode, please do. So now we are going to continue this great conversation. So Richard, welcome back.
Thanks, Maria. It's really nice to be here with you. Thank you for having me again. It's really nice to be here on Future Hacker.
Okay, so let's move forward. Let's talk about a little about the market and the industries. So basically, we've been talking how, you know, companies need to invest. You told us that recently we have some really big corporations, just like Walmart and also Amazon as well, saying how they're going to change to be carbon free and to be investing in the environment. Taking that into the consideration and all the costs that it takes to actually be investing and being able to make a positive impact in the world. So which industries do you see that are more prepared for the future? And which sectors you see that are actually at risk of extinction or replacement for new technologies that make sustainability a reality?
Well, thanks. I think it's a really interesting question. One of the things that we talk about in my book, Elevated Economics, is employee activism, as well as consumer behavior, as well as investor behavior. So on our last episode, we talked a lot about how consumers have changed their behaviors and how they, quote unquote, vote with their dollars and buy products that align with their values. We talked a little bit about investors and how investors are changing as well, and how the next generation is especially will invest in companies that align with their values. One of the things that we didn't touch on then, but I would like to touch on now, is employee activism. The most interesting example of this was Amazon. And Amazon, the employees at Amazon, they had a group. It was called Amazon Employees for Climate Justice. And they staged a walkout at Amazon headquarters. Very soon thereafter, Amazon announced a $2 billion climate pledge fund that would invest in companies building products, services, and technologies to decarbonize the economy and protect the planet. So not only do we have examples of consumers and investors being able to change the world by their actions, but also employees as well. To your question about the industries that are more prepared for a sustainable future and which sectors that I see are at risk, I would definitely say that the answer, and it's an easy answer, is extraction companies. Oil and gas, mining specifically, mainly fuel companies. They're in for a world of hurt over the long term. Now that solar and wind are coming online in a more ubiquitous fashion around the world, and how those energies are reaching and exceeding price parity with fossil fuels, it's only a matter of time. Innovation, regulatory, and market pressure will take their toll on that industry. It's done. It's just a matter of time.
That's great. And you know, when solar and wind actually become something more accessible to the population, there's no reason why, you know, people wouldn't just use it in a volume. And I'm talking about for myself that I'm actually researching about that for my home, right? To have access to solar energy and alternatives. So yes, your answer makes a lot of sense. This concept of turning what is currently an advantage to necessity in the evolving economy impacts the way we are taught business and skills needed to be a successful executive, right? also it impacts the way companies are investing in innovation, new technologies, and impacts not only R&D departments, but also how procurement currently operates. Let's divide that into two questions, right? So the first question here is, so how do you see business schools and institutions adapting to this changing scenario? What new skills are needed? We just mentioned in our first episode, you know, how we learned about, you know, the shareholders' values in the first place and the four P's of marketing, and now everything is changing. How are the schools actually adapting to that?
Well, I'll speak from personal experience. So during my time at Harvard Business School, we often heard the school referred to as the West Point of capitalism. And for those international listeners, the West Point refers to the United States Military Academy. So it's also known as West Point. And to be walking the halls of Harvard Business School and hearing the school referred to as the West Point of capitalism, at the time, we laughed, right? But the metaphor holds up. Most business education pushes towards one single goal: maximize shareholder value. In our last episode, we talked about Milton Friedman and shareholder primacy and that theory that maximizing return to shareholders at any cost, at all costs, is the purpose of business. On August 19th of 19, the Business Roundtable really turned that notion on its head, and they issued a statement of purpose of a corporation that flew in the face of a theory that had been around for 22 years, that was built on Milton Friedman's theory that's been around for 50 years. Again, maximizing shareholder value historically is what's taught at business school. The goal is to win, and the terms even, right, that we use in business school are mostly military metaphors. We're taught to, you know, capture market share. We refer to customers or companies we might want to buy as targets. We talk about our frontline employees who are quote unquote in the field, and of course, we execute, right? So there's a lot of military terminology that forces students into an us versus them false narrative about employees, customers, shareholders, stakeholders. I don't think that us versus them winner take all definition of business leadership is holding up anymore. In fact, I think it's beginning to fade. The fact that it is beginning to fade, I think, speaks volumes about how powerful this change is. We're moving from a single bottom line mindset to a triple bottom line mindset that includes not just shareholders, but all stakeholders. Bill Salmon, who's a professor at Harvard Business School, he was kind enough to endorse my book, Elevated Economics, by saying this. He said, "Richard Steele reminds us that there is more to life and business than maximizing shareholder value. When Harvard Business School was created, Dean Edwin Gay said, the purpose of business is to make a decent profit decently. That's what sensible investors will demand of the management teams that they back." So I was very grateful to Bill to give me an endorsement for the book like that. But more so, think about what this is. This is a Harvard Business School professor saying, hey, there's more to life and to business, specifically more to business than maximizing shareholder value. A statement that I don't think would have been said even 10 years ago. 15 years ago, certainly not 20 or 30 or 40 years ago. Also, Vikram Gandhi, a fantastic senior lecturer at HBS, was kind enough to write me another endorsement of the book. He said, "Through compelling real-world examples, Elevated Economics makes a strong case that purpose and stakeholder focus, not shareholder, but stakeholder focus, are core elements of successful businesses. Driven by consumers and investors, this trend is only accelerating, and corporate leadership who ignore it do so at their peril." I don't recount these quotes to you to impress you or to laud my book, but I'm really saying it to impress upon you that even these leaders at HBS are changing, and they have changed. If you look at the school, HBS now has a Business and Environment Initiative, the BEI. That initiative aims to inspire innovation at the intersection of business and the environment. So, I mean, they've got a whole division devoted to business and the environment. That initiative works to educate, connect, and mobilize business leaders to address climate change and other environmental challenges. So they have three stated goals: to engage and promote a faculty community on business and environment topics, to educate students to transform organizations to become environmentally sustainable. That's huge. And to disseminate insights from research and foster alumni engagement on critical environmental topics. You go from business schools of years past to the business schools of today, and these are the sorts of ideas that they're championing. And that, to me, gives me a lot of hope. Now, I'm a little biased. I'm on the alumni board for Harvard Business School, but I really do believe in what the school is doing. I'm completely behind them with these initiatives, and I think that they're going to build a really wonderful, sustainable future with the business leaders that come out of the school over the next few years. The BEI, this Business and Environment Initiative, it's bringing together 30 affiliated faculty members who represent 10 of the school's units, and they catalyze all that research and they share insights with business leaders, and they encourage faculty and students to address climate change, environmental sustainability, and they do that in the from the classroom to the boardroom. You know, we've been hosting academic and executive conferences and supporting student clubs and alumni connections on campus and beyond. And I could not be more hopeful or more optimistic at the changes that business schools, at least HBS, have been making towards these goals.
That's all very exciting to hear, Richard. And thank you so much for sharing. So, you know, at one side, you're going to have the business schools more prepared to these new consumers and this new reality. But on the other side, we're still going to have, leaders with different skills than what we had in the last years. And not only the leaders that are going to have to adapt, but the way the companies organize themselves and the way that they structure, for example, a procurement department. So if we see today how the reward systems in a procurement department work, it wouldn't really allow companies to be investing where they need to. And also talking about our R&D sectors, they definitely would need more investing, thinking about new technologies that actually make an impact. And I honestly, not only because that's future hacker, right? But I can't avoid thinking about access and investment in technology when talking about making a good and positive impact in the world. I think it comes hand in hand. So could you give us a little insight into that? So again, about the new skills leaders are going to need and how companies are going to be organizing themselves in order to make it happen.
So thanks, Maria. I think that's a great question. I'd like to talk about the procurement part of that question and sourcing R&D and appropriately funding R&D. R&D, research and development, is fundamental. It is the fundamental building block for all innovation, for a huge amount of growth in the business sector. That said, when you're talking about a new reward system for procurement, regulation is the answer to that. Vice President Biden has included in his policy proposals that ESG factors should be a consideration in government procurement going forward. Now, that is a sea change in the way that governments can play a role and the way that governments have decided to play a role in the past. And the details are in Vice President Biden's Build Back Better plan. And I assume that some states will follow suit and make sure that ESG factors are a consideration in their procurement as well. So with states following suit, I think that that's when you really see the exponential change. Now, to that end, California Governor Gavin Newsom just very, very recently announced that California must stay at the forefront of the fight against climate change. And so he issued an executive order that required all new cars that were sold in the state to be zero emission vehicles by 2035. So under Newsom's order, the California Air Resources Board would implement the phase out of new gas-powered cars and trucks. And they'd also require medium and heavy duty trucks to be zero emission by 2045 where possible. So California would be the first state in the nation to mandate 100% zero emission vehicles although 15 counties already have committed to phasing out gas-powered cars. But the same day that Newsom's order was revealed to the public, he also threw his support behind a ban on the use of hydraulic fracking by oil companies. So an interesting set of events that happened just recently here. Now, as far as R&D goes, this is yet another reason that, you know, elections have consequences. As they say, who wins the race for the White House is so important. So the Biden administration would apply a carbon adjustment fee against countries that are failing to meet their climate and environmental obligations to make sure that they're forced to internalize the environmental costs that they're now imposing on the rest of the world. So no more of those negative externalities that we've been talking about. So that adjustment, it stops polluting countries from undermining our workers and manufacturers, ensuring that we can lead and compete and win as we harness the opportunity, right, that we see with clean energy. And I think that the Biden administration would, if they were in power, impose a clean energy economy that gets to net zero by what they've stated as by 2050. So achieving net zero emissions by 2050. I also think that from an R&D perspective, like we were talking about before, that the Biden administration plans to make a $300 billion investment in R&D. All those breakthrough technologies, right? Electric vehicle technology to lightweight materials to 5G, artificial intelligence, right? All this to unleash high quality job creation and high value manufacturing and technology in the United States. And if anybody wants to find out more details, they can go to joebiden.com/made in America. So it's made-in-America. Now, furthermore, here are some of the reasons that who wins the White House really matters, right? Elections have consequences. For a little bit of background on R&D, total R&D spending in fiscal year 2018, which that's the last year that we had complete official data, was about $144 billion. So FY19, about $4 to $5 billion higher. And we got to think about R&D and what that means from a government perspective. The D in R&D is mostly near-term technology for the Department of Defense, right? So the systems that they're working on, so military stuff. For basic and applied research, the current budget is about $80 billion. Now, a research budget as percent of GDP has been about 0.44% of U.S. GDP for spending on basic and applied research. So that's a pretty paltry research intensity, right? Research intensity is research expressed as a share of GDP, so half of a percent. And to get back to the post-war average, we need increases of about 6.8% per year for 5 years. And the congressional average has been less than that. It's been about 4.5 to 5% for basic and applied research. And the funding should really focus in particular on engineering and physical sciences, because investment as percentage in those areas has really eroded over time. So not to get too in the weeds on this, but most of the current research budget is taken up by life sciences and physical sciences, right? So chemistry, physics, engineering, computer science, math, et cetera. And that has declined to 34% of the Fed's portfolio. And those areas, by the way, used to be the largest part of the portfolio. All of those sciences are fundamental building blocks for computing, AI, et cetera. So we want to see federal research budgets have increases of about 8.4% increase over 5 years for the National Science Foundation, Department of Energy, the National Institute of Standards and Technology, and the Department of Defense, and 5.9% increases for 5 years, so every year for 5 years, for the National Institutes of Health, especially right now, of course, with COVID. USDA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Association, the Environmental Protection Agency, U.S. Geological Survey, and the Department of Transportation. So, again, who wins the White House really matters. I'm sorry to throw all those numbers at you, but if there is a Biden administration and R&D is appropriately funded, the spillover effects are just huge. So it really is so meaningful to be able to dig in the numbers just a little bit like we just did. And hopefully that gives you a great answer on your R&D question from both a regulatory and a funding perspective, as well as some of the other issues that we've talked about so far today. So thanks for asking the question.
Yes, a lot of great content today, Richard. And you know what? No matter what happens, still with all those movement that is inevitable, and with all those changes in consumer behavior, and as you say, the great wealth migration and all those big corporations making the change and making the example, right, for the other companies. Somehow everything just made me more optimistic about our future. And, you know, for our listeners, if you're still interested in learning more about everything we discussed today, just make sure you get your copy of Elevated Economics. I did, and it really got my attention. It's really interesting, a lot of great stuff. So, Richard, unfortunately, you know, we have to end the interview. Do you have any last words you'd like to say?
Well, first of all, I appreciate you having me. I think that this is a time for optimism. I think this is a time where we can be optimistic, even amidst all the headwinds that 2020 has thrown at us so far and will continue to throw at us undoubtedly over time, that this is really a time for optimism. And it is a time for change. It's a time for everybody to vote with their dollars. And if your listeners would like to get more information on any of this, they can find it at elevatedeconomics.org. And I look forward to hearing from some of them. Thank you again so much for having me today. Great show.
Future Hacker. Life. Path. Future.
Apoio Instituto Brasileiro de Ciências e Inovações.